Wishing you a very good morning. This is a live reading of the Green Valley News from Sun Sounds of Arizona in Tucson. My name is Mark DeGroft. Weather today, high 75 at low 46 tonight, humidity at 34%, 83% cloud cover, wind is southwest at 7 miles per hour, no chance of rain. Sunrise this morning, 07:03:23. Tonight, sunset, 5:19:46. Cloudy today, high around 75. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a low 46. Winds are light and variable. Tomorrow, partly cloudy skies. 73 degrees Fahrenheit for your Thanksgiving. Winds out of the west-northwest of 5 to 10 miles per hour. And it is currently 57 degrees in Green Valley. Good morning, Mark DeGroft with you. And let's see what's happening in Green Valley and Sorita this morning, this day before Thanksgiving. And the town is reevaluating a solid waste contract and still eyeing benefits. The town of Sorita is taking a step back on a proposed single town-wide solid waste contract to reevaluate options and gather more community feedback. The single provider contract with Waste Connections of Arizona was expected to go before the town council on December 9th, but town manager Shane Dill said that is no longer going to happen. A town spokesperson said that despite past surveys showing positive feedback from residents, the town realized there are residents that surveys didn't reach, adding that the town needs to do more to get the final price to where residents feel comfortable with a centralized service. The town's consulting firm, Burns & McDonnell, told the town council on November 18th that it identified Waste Connections as the lowest bidder in a single provider contract, beating out Waste Management and Republic Services. Waste Connections offered the town $18.18 to $19.69 per month for the base services. Waste Management was slightly higher at $21.95 to $22.44 per month, with Republic coming in at the highest at $28.53 to $29.43. Jack Simmons with Burns and McDonald told the council that Sorita residents typically pay $34 to $61 per month for that service. Their proposed Waste Connections contract would have cost residents $24.50 a month, billed quarterly for $73.50. The monthly cost was pulled from two scenarios totaling $24.50. Both had Waste Connection services fee at $18.18, with scenario number one adding $1.51 for can purchases by the contractor and a $4.51 town administration fee. Scenario number two had can purchases by the town at $1.61 and $4.71 town admin fee. The town was expected to see a final contract on December 9th with service beginning on July 1st. The town council would have to first approve a new ordinance before the July 1st date, mandating only one solid waste vendor for single-family residential areas and places with four units or less operating within the town limits. Residential dwellings with five or more units and commercial properties were exempt from the mandatory service. The Waste Connection service contract included trash, recycling, and bulk pickup services. It also included trash collection for some town events. Dill said the town received a lot of feedback from residents, and it's the staff's turn now to do more homework based on the insights and the information, adding it won't go back to the council until the time is right. He said the town doesn't want to rush anything that affects every resident. Sorita resident Mel Selway told the council during the November 18th meeting that he was concerned about his current waste solid vendor charging him at $150 to return his trash and recycling cans when the town switched to Waste Connections. Waste Connections' Ty Tostenson said the company would reach out to other vendors to ask for waivers, but he urged the town to do the same. Ultimately, waiving the return fees would be up to the vendors. Dill said that residents seeing the rates for the first time after they were presented during the November 18th meeting produced a lot of feedback, particularly from many residents in the Madera Highlands community. Many residents in Madera Highlands receive service through Republic at a lower rate than the Waste Connection service would provide. My understanding is that there is not a master contract out there, at least not one that I've seen, he said. But at some point in time, a rate was negotiated, and the HOA says, hey, here's our preferred vendor. My understanding is not everyone uses that vendor, but the lion's share do. Dill found it strange that Republic came in highest during the bidding process for townwide service, but had a lower rate within a single neighborhood. If you look at the rates of the neighborhood and that vendor, and you look outside of that neighborhood with the same vendor, there's a stark contrast in rates, he said. Which really kind of proves the point that the town is trying to do, where the more we can leverage all the accounts of the community, intuitively, you would think we could negotiate the absolute best rate possible out there. As for community feedback, Dill said that there were past surveys, council discussions, and coverage in the Green Valley News and Suarita's Sun for about a year leading up to the November 18th council meeting. He said extending the town staff's reach by having forums in different neighborhoods is one idea moving forward. It's hard, I get it, Dill said, about some residents being caught unaware by the solid waste contract. Life can be all-consuming, and what's most important to the average household is paying the bills and putting food on the table. And you don't have a lot of extra discretionary time to be engaged in local government and to follow what's happening. The town is also considering creating a frequently asked questions page explaining why town staff is pursuing a single solid waste vendor for residents. Dill said that Suarita stands out in his experience working for communities statewide since 2000 in how solid waste and water are not part of utilities. It is common for utility services to include solid waste to be provided by the local government, he said. That way, the residents are really in charge. They can come talk with the town council if they don't think services are being provided right. So really, it's very common for those services to be provided. He said with a private system, residents need to call vendors and then, quote, hope for the best, end quote. It isn't just resident control that Dill pointed to as a single contract benefit. He said safety concerns topped the list, with a single vendor leading to fewer trucks making collections in the neighborhoods. He said accidents are a matter of time with narrow residential roads and increased garbage truck traffic. The town is also concerned about the additional damage extra garbage truck traffic can cause to the roads. A typical car weighs 1.5 tons. A standard truck comes in at about 3 tons. An average loaded garbage truck weighs about 25 tons. Dill said the town has newer roads that are in good condition, with residents enjoying the lack of potholes and cracking found in Suarita. But as the road gets older, it gets harder and harder to maintain that condition, he said. The heavy trucks on these roads are exacerbating the problem. They have tandem axles and they're very heavy, so when they turn corners or try to turn around in a cul-de-sac, it really beats up the roads bad. Dill said those unforeseen and unrealized costs may not come to the public mind, but town staff sees department costs increase each year without an excessive amount of new roads being added to the town. A single solid waste contract would also ensure every resident has trash service, Dill said. That could cut down on illegal wildcat dumping in the surrounding desert or people using trash bins at businesses. While the town pulled the solid waste contract from the December 9th agenda, Dill said that further discussions with Mayor Tom Murphy, Vice Mayor Kara Egbert, would help provide a plan going forward. He said there could also be potential executive sessions with the town council for more discussion related to the contract itself. State law permits executive sessions for legal, personnel, and contract discussions. In the meantime, Town staff and the council members will have to continue reevaluating what a single contract vendor would look like before moving forward, with Dill saying that it's a big decision for the council and it's a big deal for the community. "We want to make sure that we're doing things right," he said. "There's a lot of reasons why the town has been working on this for the past year and getting ourselves to this point." 9:41 and change here, Sun Sounds. On November 8th, Colonel Gabriel Brown, the deputy commander of the 335th Wing at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, spoke to the Green Valley Aero Club about changes at the base over the upcoming years. "Changes are always going on in the military, but right now I would say it's more than any other time in my career," Brown said, referring to a shift in focus from the Middle East to a near-peer competitor, China. "We recently had an Air Force Association conference in September in D.C., and Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall said the threat is very real." Brown said the threat may not be imminent, but it is certainly real. "We have a near-peer competitor out there, and we need to reoptimize our force for that pacing competitor." Brown also discussed changes coming to special use airspace around Tucson in general and into New Mexico. Brown said that the Air Force is finding that their current airspace isn't adequate for training of fifth-generation aircraft and capabilities. "The Air Force will develop an air task force, which is designed to be a unit of action that conduct combat missions and return. The Air Force has created 6 of these across the country. Davis-Monthan will house one of them, called the 11th Air Task Force. This organization is made up of about 300 people, is meant to create a command and control and a combat support entity so that we can go out and do the mission," Brown said. "At DM, we're going to see our wing break into 2 parts. One half will be a deployable combat wing. The other half will be an airbase wing that stays behind and provides the support. Colonel Scott Mills, who is the current wing commander, is setting up the wing right now for that eventual separation that will occur in 2026, Brown said. Another change will include divestment in the A-10 Warthog. "I know it's really tough for the Tucson community. The Tucson community has also been behind maintaining our A-10s, especially throughout the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. But that aircraft cannot, unfortunately, compete in near-peer war like the war against the Chinese Communist Party," Brown said. In September, 3 A-10 squadrons were divested. The operational squadron, the 354th Bulldogs, was closed down after returning from a deployment at 2 locations between Al Darfa Air Force Base in the United Arab Emirates and in Jordan. They were conducting close air support and strike missions. When they returned back in April, Brown said, they used their remaining months to close down the unit. The 2 remaining squadrons will be used for training the next generation of pilots. "We do still have some A-10 guard units that are open, and we currently have an active duty A-10 unit as well. Those will shut down, with the last A-10 units shutting down somewhere in the ballpark of 2028. The units at DM, Davis-Monthan, will shut down in 2025. He said it's in the Air Force's best interest to continue using A-10s for training up to the last date for the aircraft, since those pilots will be able to transfer their experience over to other aircraft like the F-35 Lightning II. Other aircraft changes include divesting the EC-130H and replacing them with the EA-37 Bravo. Right now, I believe there's 3 left on the ramp," Brown said, "and as these dwindle down, the EA-370B will take its place as the premier electronic attack aircraft for the Air Force and really for the military. This is a key component of near-peer flight." 9:45, Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's feast. Thanks to Country Club of GV, fire crews get proper Thanksgiving dinner. On Monday, a seemingly endless stream of sacks came out of the backs of SUVs at Santa Rita Fire Station District 152, sacks that were then divvied up into 5 piles and then redistributed into SRFD vehicles. Combined, the sacks contained a veritable feast, specifically a Thanksgiving feast, and all thanks to the Country Club of Green Valley. In 2021, club member Raquel Finkbeiner thought how wonderful it would be to show the members of the Fire District how appreciative the community is for all they do, said Vice President Pam White. So the country club raised enough money to donate Thanksgiving dinner to one station's crew, and they've been adding more stations every year. This marks the first year every station will receive a 20-plus pound turkey, potatoes, pies, and all of the other traditional fixings, she said. We're really thrilled that we can do this. This is one more chance to give back to the community that we love so much, White said. Chief Chuck Wonder was on hand when the sacks began arriving on Monday morning. We are so grateful to the Country Club of Green Valley for their generous support and for the Thanksgiving dinners, Wonder said. This is just another great example of the tremendous support we receive from the community. SRFD crews work 365 days a year, often giving up their birthdays, holidays, and other special days with their families. And thanks to the Country Club of Green Valley, the crews will be able to invite their families for Thanksgiving dinner at their respective stations, Wonder said. Captain Corey Potter said that whenever he speaks to other fire departments and districts, they're always jealous of the support that Santa Rita Fire Department receives from the community. This is huge for our crews, Potter said. This means the world. This makes it easier for us to do our jobs when we know we have support of our community. Okay, let's take a look at, A little short on news today. So today in history, actually today, yesterday in history, on November 26th of 1948, the first land camera, better known today as the instant Polaroid camera, goes on sale at Jordan Marsh department stores in Boston for $89.75. The invention of Edwin H. Land, who had enrolled at Harvard to study physics in 1926 but dropped out to conduct his own research, becomes an instant hit and sells out within minutes of that first day. The camera, dubbed Model 95A, debuted the technology of instant photography decades before modern digital photos. These cameras would shoot out a piece of line film that quickly developed the image that the camera had captured. The Polaroid camera remained popular for the rest of the 20th century and competed with Kodak, which developed film with a time-consuming and an old-fashioned way with chemicals in a dark room and printing. Land's daughter, Jennifer, was the muse that led to his invention of instant photography. Back in 1943, while walking together, the three-year-old girl asked her father why she couldn't see the picture he had just taken of her. That gave Land, who was co-founder of Land Wheelwright Laboratories, later called the Polaroid Corporation in Cambridge, Mass., an idea. Why not invent a camera that produces photos much more quickly? He figured out a way to develop both the negative and positive image in 1 minute and then produce a dry, stabilized print. At a time when consumers typically waited days for photos to be developed professionally, the ability to see photos develop right before their eyes from their own cameras actually proved mesmerizing. In less than a decade after its 1948 debut, the millionth Model 95A came off the production line, having revolutionized photography. In 1963, Polaroid's business expanded significantly when the company introduced its color film after 15 years of sepia and then black and white prints. But as digital photography technology emerged at the dawn of the new millennium, Polaroid struggled to keep up and it shuttered in 2008. In 2017, Austrian entrepreneur Florian Kapps started the impossible project to save the Polaroid and its analog technology, and now retro-style Polaroid cameras are made and sold today for people who love the nostalgic feel of instant yet still physical photography that predates the internet and the cell phone era. Okay. Green Valley Gardeners, time to get your favorite holiday plant. This time each year, many local nonprofit organizations, maybe including your favorite group, raise funds by taking orders for what is America's favorite holiday flower, the poinsettia. Appropriately, its botanical name, Euphorbia Pulcherrima means very beautiful in its native Mexico, where it can grow up to 10 feet tall. What is referred to as a flower is actually a set of colorful modified leaves, or bracts, that's B-R-A-C-T-S, that surround the small berry-like clusters of yellow flowers. And because of many years of hybridizing, there are now plants from which to choose in a wide range of bract colors. However, those of bright red still remain the most popular. When making your selection, check that there is little or no yellow pollen on the flower clusters. Those that shed pollen will soon drop bracts as well. And poinsettias should be carefully wrapped for the trip home. Temperatures below 50 degrees Fahrenheit for even a few minutes can damage the plant. When arriving home, place your poinsettia where you can get direct light for 6 hours a day. It's important to keep it out of drafts from doors and windows or registers. Daytime temperatures of 60 to 70 degrees are ideal, with 55 degrees at night. Higher temperatures may shorten the plant's life. Typical of the Euphorbia family, it oozes a milky sap, which can be a skin irritant, so handle it carefully. Many gardeners prefer to buy a new plant annually from their favorite charity rather than convince one to rebloom. To begin another blooming cycle during February or March, cut back flowering stems at 4 to 6 inches to encourage the new growth. And later in the spring, repot the plant into a slightly larger container. Next, place it into a sunny indoor location, moving it outside when nighttime temperatures are consistently in the 60s. And to acclimate the plant, put it in the shade for the first 2 to 3 weeks, and then sink the pot into a protected location where it gets afternoon shade, such as on the east or north side of the house. To maintain even growth, turn the container regularly, occasionally pinch back growing shoots to encourage branching, and all summer give it regular watering and fertilize it every 2 weeks with a soluble complete 20-20-20 fertilizer. At night, temperatures again reach below 55 to 60 degrees. When that happens, bring the plant back inside to a sunny location. Without long periods of darkness, it will grow and produce leaves, but no flowers. For blooms next Christmas, keep your poinsettia completely dark from 5 p.m. to 8 a.m., from the end of September until December 15th with only daytime sunlight. During this critical period, even streetlights can prevent flowering. Be sure no artificial light is on the plant for the entire 8 hours. Entire night hours, that is. A simple way to control this is to set a cardboard box over your poinsettia each evening. And whether you enjoy the challenge of getting your plant to rebloom or wish to purchase a fresh poinsettia from your favorite organization each year, take pleasure in this colorful and traditional prize. It's like having another kid, sounds like to me. Okay, briefly, at 9:53, what are the qualifications to be President of the United States? When the United States Constitution was being drafted and ratified, the founders debated over what qualifications to impose on the nation's highest offices. Some delegates argued that members of Congress shouldn't be debtors or foreign-born. Others insisted that all federal officers should be landowners. A few believed that there should be almost no qualifications or restrictions on who holds a federal office, and that the voter should decide who is best equipped. In the end, the framers of the Constitution chose to include just 3 qualifications for the office of United States President, and they are all laid out in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5, which reads, "No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of President. Neither shall any person be eligible to that office who shall not have attained the age of 35 years and been 14 years a resident within the United States." Unlike European aristocracies, where only wealth-landed gentlemen could rule, America's Constitution imposed no financial requirements or religious tests on who was fit for that office. So the basic qualifications, according to the Constitution, there are just 3. The person must be 35 years old. Secondly, the person must be a natural-born citizen, meaning they were either born on American soil or born abroad to American parents. The president cannot become an American citizen through the naturalization process. And three, the person must have lived in the United States for at least 14 years. At the Constitutional Convention in 1787, the founders debated the minimum age for federal officers, with George Mason proposing 25 for members of the House, and James Wilson arguing that there shouldn't be any age restrictions at all. James Madison, in his minutes of the convention, reported Wilson saying there was no more reason for incapacitating youth than age when the requisite qualifications were found. And in the end, the founders settled on three different minimum ages, 25 for the House, 30 for the Senate, and 35 for the presidency and vice presidency. Mueller says the president's minimum age must have been met by Inauguration Day. A 34-year-old could be elected president in November of an election year, but they'd need to turn 35 before January 20th in order to take office. The founders universally supported a citizenship requirement, and there wouldn't have been any confusion about what it means to be a natural-born citizen. That language was common in 18th-century British law, which recognized all children born to British parents as natural-born subjects, even if they were born outside of the British Empire. Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution states that a president or other federal officials can be impeached and removed from office if convicted by Congress of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Only three U.S. presidents have been impeached, Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump, twice, but none was convicted and removed. If they had been convicted, though, could they run again for president and serve another term? The short answer is no. Article 1, Section 3, Clause 7 of the Constitution states, in part, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. However, constitutional scholars debated the scope of the impeachment disqualification clause. To the framers, the phrase any office under the United States did not apply to any state positions, so an impeached and convicted president could still hold any state position, says Seth Barrett Tillman, who is an American law professor at Maynooth University School of Law and Criminology in Ireland. And two more disqualifications, term limits and insurrection. Mueller says the Constitution mentions two other situations in which people would be disqualified or barred from being president. The 22nd Amendment, ratified in 1951, formally imposed a two-term limit on U.S. presidents. Starting with George Washington, all American presidents stepped down after two terms if reelected. That custom was broken by FDR, who was reelected to historic third and fourth terms in 1940 and 1944 as America was embroiled in World War II. And the Constitution's only other disqualification for the president came in 1868 in the wake of the Civil War, where lawmakers sought to prevent former Confederate officers from occupying seats in the United States Congress and state legislatures. No person shall be a senator or a representative in Congress or elected president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or any other state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or a member or officer of any other state to support the Constitution or insurrection or rebellion against the same, shall not hold office or give an aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may vote a 2/3 of vote each House, removing such a disability. And that will take care of the reading of the Green Valley News. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. I wish you a very, very safe holiday. Good weekend. See you next week.